If it had been anyone else, I wouldn't have been able to read their minds, nor they mine. But my Fraz had been raised, trained by Orlo. They had figured out, probably sooner than I had, that in 45 minutes the nuke would reappear on the other side of Arb. Just as important, they were relying on me, entrusting me with their lives, to figure out the same thing and to act accordingly. And what did act accordingly mean? It meant stay calm and don't mess with the orbit that I was in. If I took no action, they'd be able to anticipate my position. If I did something, though, they'd have no way of predicting my whereabouts. I didn't have much in the way of emergency supplies, just a blanket of metallized poly, like the emergency blanket they had issued to Orlo after his anathem, taped to the chest of my suit. It was to be used to block the light of the sun where necessary, from striking our matte black suits with full force and overheating them, which would force the chiller to work harder and use more oxygen. I peeled mine loose and unfolded it, not easy with Skella hands, and used it to cover as much of the nuke as I could, then snuggled beneath it. Line of sight established. Supposing they were looking, the telescopes on the Dabanernud could now see me, albeit as just another hunk of crud thrown up in the 200-missile launch. Chaff. Let's put this in perspective. The Dabanernud was something like 14,000 miles away. At their closest approach to Arb, the whole planet looked as big to them as a pie held at arm's length. At their farthest, the size of a saucer. For them to see my spread-out blanket at this distance was like trying to spot a gum wrapper from 100 miles away. Worse, or for me, better, it was like looking at a whole field covered with litter, trying to pick out a single gum wrapper from all the rest. On the other hand, Leo, who had brought Praxic-age exoatmospheric weapon systems with him to the Convox, had cautioned us not to get cocky, and Jules had added weight to this by telling us how the Ernudans, past masters of space warfare, had coupled syndevs to excellent telescopes, enabling them to sift through vast numbers of images to find things that didn't look right. Decoys, for example, were easy to detect because they were usually nothing more than balloons whose huge size and light weight made them feel the drag of the evanescent atmosphere much more than real payloads. So decoy orbits behaved a little differently from non-decoy ones. Moreover, once the Ernudans had created a census of all the stuff that the 200-missile launch had flung into orbit, they would be in a position to notice if anything went missing or changed to a new orbit. This could only happen if it had thrusters and guidance on board. So, in that sense, we had already screwed up the mission. We had to fall back on safety in numbers, the hope that my blanket's sudden disappearance from the junk cloud would not be noticed soon enough for the pedestal to do anything about it. But I was getting ahead of myself. In order for this blanket to suddenly disappear, I was going to have to rendezvous with the others. That would be easier with oxygen. I closed my eyes, tried to relax, tried to stop thinking about the pedestal and their admirable telescopes and their syndevs. Here was that rare circumstance where worrying too much actually could kill me. Once my pulse had dropped to a more reasonable range, I found the keyboards in my arm stumps and typed messages to Cord and to Ayla, in case I died and the suit was recovered later with its memory intact. The suit's syndev included an orbital theorics calculator, which one almost never had time to use in the heat of the moment, but I fired it up and used it to verify some of my hunches as to what I'd need to do when I drew within range of the others. It was infuriatingly difficult to concentrate, though. My brain had become like an old sponge that has sopped up more water than it can hold. In zero gravity, there was almost no contact between the suit and the person wearing it. Air, at just the right temperature, circulated all around my naked body. It was like taking a bath in air. Behind my back was a small chemical plant going full tilt, but I was only aware of it as a source of gentle white noise. Other than that, I heard nothing except the beating of my own heart. Normally, I could get a jolt of excitement simply by opening my eyes and looking out the face mask. I'm in space. But now all I could see was the backside of a crinkly blanket, as if I were poultry in a roasting pan. So it was not difficult to feel drowsy. My body and my mind had never had so many reasons to want rest. Between jet lag and training, we had slept very little at Elkhazg, and not at all in the last 24 hours. The last half hour had been absurdly stressful, just the kind of experience after which any sane person would want to crawl under the covers of a warm bed and cry himself to sleep. The only thing that kept me from passing out instantly was fear of my own sleepiness. After the training we'd been through, I now knew the symptoms of carbon dioxide poisoning better than the alphabet. Nausea, check. Dizziness, check. Vomiting, check. Headache, check. But who wouldn't have all of those symptoms after being kicked up a 100-mile-high staircase by a magnifique? What came next? Oh yeah, almost forgot. Drowsiness and confusion. I checked the readouts in my screen. Checked them again. Closed my eyes, waited for my vision to clear, checked them a third time. They were fine. Oxygen tank level was yellow, which was to be expected, after all the heavy breathing. The oxygen content of the air I was breathing was fine, and the CO2 level was zero. The scrubber was taking all of it out. But if I were drowsy and confused, might I be reading the numbers wrong?